Hello, and welcome to Wiki Politiki, a show designed to bring right and left front and center, to turn the funk into function, and leave the junk at the junction. At a time when so much political discourse is heat without light, Wiki Politiki shines the light of love and truth on the darkened corridors of power, and then brings leading solutionaries into conversation to light the way forward together. Your host is Steve Behrman, author, comedian, and political and spiritual uncommentator. You might know Steve as his cosmic comic alter ego, Swami Beyondananda, or as the author of a more serious book with cellular biologist Bruce Lipton, Spontaneous Evolution. If you recognize that crisis precipitates evolution, and judging by the current crises, the chances of precipitation are 100%, this show is for you. Welcome to the Evolutionary Upwising. Now, here is your host, Steve Behrman.
Well, hello and welcome to Wiki Politiki, Conversations for Co-Creation, where we shed light on the darkened corridors of power and shine a light ahead of us to the path where evolution is leading. The purpose of our Wiki Politiki radio podcast is to bring left and right, front and center, to face the music and dance together, to address problems rather than defend positions. We have another purpose, too, and that is to provide context at a time when the content can be contradictory, confusing, and overwhelming. Speaking of context, we have a mighty rich show today, bringing together ancient Vedic philosophy and the very present political and, I would say, spiritual crisis we face. My guest today, Philip Goldberg, is someone who has bridged the gap between Vedic philosophy and modern Western culture. He's the award-winning author of American Veda, From Emerson and the Beatles to Yoga and Meditation, How Indian Spirituality Changed the West. He's also the author of Road Signs on the Spiritual Path, Living at the Heart of Paradox, and his new book, very exciting, that we're going to be talking about, a comprehensive biography of Paramahansa Yogananda titled The Life of Yogananda, The Story of the Yogi Who Became the First Modern Guru. Philip is a meditation teacher. He's an ordained interfaith minister and also the co-host of the popular Spirit Matters podcast, and he leads American Veda tours to India. Now, Philip and I have a history that goes back to well before we met. We actually attended the same junior high school in Brooklyn, Junior High School 210, which was at the time celebrated as the worst junior high in New York City. We survived it, and our conversation today will cover the very curious attraction Americans have had to yoga and the Vedic traditions, and also the influence of the first spiritual teacher from India to really bring the Vedas to this country and have it stick, Yogananda, and of course the current movement to create a sane and coherent sense of the sacred that transcends both religion and non-religion. Welcome, Phil.
Hey, good to be with you, Steve.
Good. And you know, one more thing. We also shared a common spiritual path when we were kids that was, I would say, more important to us than the Jewish tradition we were raised in. And that spiritual path was, of course, the Brooklyn Dodgers.
Oh, that is sacred. Now you are invoking sacred names.
Sacred names. The Gil Hodges and Roy Campanella and Duke Snyder and Jackie Robinson and Pee Wee Reese and so on. And you also wrote a book about a novel about the Dodgers, didn't you?
Yes, it was a family in 1955 in the neighborhood you and I grew up in, who helps the Dodgers win the World Series, their one and only World Series while they were in Brooklyn.
Yeah, I read the book and it really brought back a lot. Anyway, we're going to have a fun –
Can I just mention the title?
Yes. Yes, you can, please.
This is next year.
Of course, because anybody from Brooklyn remembers the slogan, wait till next year. And finally, that next year happened in 1955.
Right.
Anyway, let's just begin with a little background, your own spiritual and political history and development, your amazing breakthrough book, American Veda. How did a Jewish boy from Brooklyn become enthralled and involved with the Vedic teachings and then come to write American Veda?
Well, I grew up, my parents were in the Karl Marx School of Religion when I was growing up, so I had it would be an understatement to say it was a non-religious household, because it was really more of an anti-religious household. So I had a very jaundiced view of religion. It was a very political household, very lefty, and all very highly ethical and moral and wonderful parents, but they had no use for religion, and I had none. And I carried that way of looking at the world into my college years in the 60s. And was very politically active in the days of the civil rights and anti-Vietnam War movements, and very active on campus and other things, demonstrations and all. And that was how I thought the world would change, was through political activism. At the same time, the spirit of the 60s gradually took hold in me, and I just didn't know how one is supposed to live a fulfilled, satisfactory life in the world, because all the conventional wisdom seemed vapid and empty and misery-making. And so I didn't find any guidelines for how to live, and so I was very confused. And when I turned to the bigger questions of life, who are we, what are we doing here, what's it all about, and all that, I found no satisfactory answers, and certainly not politics, and certainly not psychology, not conventional wisdom of, earn a living and make money. And so I was searching and searching and searching, and somehow in that environment of me and my contemporaries searching on the sort of fringes of what became the counterculture, books were passed around, and some of those books were the classic texts that come from the East, like the Bhagavad Gita and the Upanishads and the Tao Te Ching, and commentaries by respected elders like Alan Watts and Aldous Huxley and people like that about Eastern philosophy. And somehow it just all resonated with me. And you add to that certain cultural things going on, like Ravi Shankar's music and the Beatles going to India, and the Eastern sort of flavors that filtered into the counterculture. And I just got swept away in it, and it made a lot of sense to me. What was called mysticism just seemed like a perfectly rational way to look at the world. And the emphasis on direct spiritual experience as a practical way to have a more fulfilling life, it all just made sense to me, and I just poured myself into it.
How did you become connected with the Maharishi? How did that come about?
Through the same mechanisms. When the Beatles learned transcendental meditation from Maharishi Mahesh Yogi in 1967, It made a splash all over the world, especially in young people who, looked up to the Beatles and took seriously anything they got engaged in. And then when a few months later, in early 68, more than 50 years ago, if you need to feel old.
and we all, if you believe in reincarnation, there's no such thing as old, but yeah.
No such thing, right? But in this body, it is a long time ago. They went to India famously, and in fact, I'll be leaving for India by the time this airs. I'll be at the ashram where they actually visited, and so it was in the air as a practical methodology of meditation, and eventually I tried it out, and it worked for me. I took to it very deeply, and became fascinated by learning more, and so was trained by Maharishi to become one of the early TM teachers in like 1970.
You know, right around that time, 1971, I remember being in Santa Barbara. I saw this fascinating article about TM on the science of, what did they call it, creative intelligence? What's the
science of creative intelligence.
Science of creative intelligence, and it really being similar to you in terms of not super religious household and having rejected the Abrahamic religions as being forms of crowd control, I took to it, and I was initiated into TM in 1972, coming at it from the science of creative intelligence. I think that was that was quite a an astute marketing ploy by Maharishi and his people. Say
yes.
More about.
But we should say
who,
he was not.
Yeah.
He was not the first to link the yogic or Vedic philosophies and practices with modern science. That started with Swami Vivekananda in the 1890s, and Yogananda, who we'll talk about, was very much into it as well. Maharishi just took it to another level because he was able at that time to advocate for people doing direct studies of what happens when people meditate, because the scientific technology was able to look into those things.
Now, you then spent time with him, in real time. He's been characterized as somebody who liked to laugh a lot. What was he like? What was it like to to be around Maharishi?
He liked to laugh a lot. He did. He was called the giggling guru by the press, because it was genuine. He just found the world very amusing, and he had a great sense of humor. I must say that just as somebody who was around him a lot in the days when we were prone to, putting gurus like him on pedestals and looking up to them, it was a great pleasure to make him laugh. And but he was also an extremely serious guy, and worked long hours, very hard, to do his bit to enlighten the world. And he took that mission seriously, so seriously, people accused him of having delusions of grandeur. But he was very serious about that mission and worked very hard right until his death at like 90 or 91.
Now, what do you think, what was the most interesting thing you learned while researching and writing American Veda? What was the great ahas of this book?
Well, when I set out to write it, I knew that the teachings that started in India that we call yoga or Hinduism or Vedic had, and add to that Buddhism, which also started in India, they had penetrated American culture to a larger extent than people realized. And I set out to chronicle that. In the course of doing my research, I came to realize it was even more influential than I thought it was when I started writing the book or started working on the project, because I found that it had you know, filtered its way into people's lives and into disciplines like psychology and physics and neuroscience and medical care to a much larger extent than I thought it did previously. And I came to more fully appreciate that it was a catalyst, if not the main ingredient, for a real spiritual revolution. You know, I became aware of data on people's religious attitudes and their spiritual practices, the way they view these things. And over time, you saw a pattern where people's view of spirituality, religion, their place in the universe, God, questions like that, gradually became, with each generation and each decade, more like what we think of as Eastern than like the Western Abrahamic traditions. In fact, shortly before I finished my book, the religion editor of Newsweek noticed the same trends and wrote an article with the headline, "We Are All Hindus Now." And I took that as validation for my own observations. And since then, I realized, in fact, I just wrote an article for a publication in India where I say, you know, she wrote that about 9 or 10 years ago. If I were writing that now, I would say we are all yogis now, because that influence, you know, Hindu has a religious, it's a religious word in people's minds. This transcends religion. It has to do more with what yoga represents. And by yoga, of course, I don't mean just the bending and stretching that, you know, has become synonymous with yoga, but the deep yoga of the mystics and the swamis and the great sages of India, the meditative yoga, that transcends the designations we attribute to religious beliefs and dogmas and all that. And so we have in America now, you know, Christian yogis and Jewish yogis and atheist yogis, secular yogis and yogi yogis, and you know, it's people who see the world in that way, and you know, there's a great variety of it. And so, that is a long answer to your question, but it was the extent of it and the famous people who were influenced by Eastern philosophy, by the Vedanta and yogic ideas, whom I was not aware of when I first set out to write the book. But there were a lot of them.
We're about to take a little break, and we come back, we'll talk about Yogananda, and then we'll talk about the implications of this spirituality in our lives right now. I'm talking with Philip Goldberg, and he's the author of a new biography of Paramahansa Yogananda. Steve Behrman, this is WikiPoliticky.
Connecting you with the best of the conscious minds in the world. Om Times Radio, IOM FM. Om Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. Om Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
More than 24 million Americans have an autoimmune disorder, and that number continues to grow. I'm Sharon Saylor, and I'm one of those 24 million. To put that number in perspective, cancer affects about 9 million and heart disease up to 22 million. That's why I've brought together top experts and those thriving regardless of their diagnosis to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information. Join me, Sharon Saylor, Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern, for the Autoimmune Hour on Life Interrupted Radio to find out how to live your life uninterrupted.
Are you done with the daily barrage of negativity? Ready for some positivity? Creations Magazine has been inspiring the soul for over 30 years, delivering thought-provoking and solution-driven articles, essays, and poetry that inspire you to enjoy a vibrant life. Holistic health, personal and spiritual growth, relationships, the environment, and so much more. Read us online or order a subscription, creationsmagazine.com.
I'm Fidel Nshombo. I was born in a city called the Bukavu in the Congo. We were a loving family. And then, boom, everything that I had disappeared in a single day. People think that when you are a refugee and they resettle to America, and all your problems are done. They don't understand that that's the beginning of everything. I was not born a refugee. I was made one.
It's time we welcome refugee families with open arms. Learn more at EmbraceRefugees.org, brought to you by the Ad Council.
Well, we're back with Philip Goldberg. He's the author of American Veda. He's also the author of a new book about Paramahansa Yogananda, and we're going to talk about that in this segment. Again, 1972, the same woman friend who took me to my first yoga class, handed me a copy of Autobiography of a Yogi. And I found this one of the most glorious and inspiring books I had read up to that time. Maybe that was my first introduction to, even though I'd gone to a yoga class, my first introduction to this path. And so, Philip, tell us, first of all, how did you come to take on writing a book about the guy that already wrote a book about himself, and let's also talk about the influence of Paramahansa Yogananda and his political approach.
Yeah, well, the question you ask is the one I'm asked most often, or especially when I first told people I was working on a biography of Yogananda, they would say, well, he's written Autobiography of a Yogi. What's there to say? And the answer is he left out a lot. that's the short answer. A little bit more specifically, he came to America in 1920. He was only 27 years old, and he lived here, with the exception of one trip back to India and some time in Europe, for the rest of his life, and he died at 59. This is where, here in America, he became famous, where he did his work, where he wrote his autobiography, where he established a worldwide organization for teaching the methods of his lineage and the philosophy of India. And yet, less than 10% of his own autobiography is about those years. And so there was a lot to fill in and a lot of research to do. And that's why it made sense for another person, an objective, historically informed researcher, to write a bona fide biography. The other reason, the reason I was interested in him in the first place, is he too was somebody who influenced my spiritual path. I read Autobiography of a Yogi in 1970. I did not become a disciple of Yogananda's or a formal student, because I was already on the path we mentioned earlier. I was about to become a TM teacher. But the book blew me away, and like many other people, I cherished it, and I've read it several times over the years. I still have the same copy. It was a $5 hardcover. And so I respected him and admired him, and then when I wrote American Veda, I had a lot, I researched him as I did all the other gurus who ever came here, and I came to find that his personal story, the narrative of, birth to death, as we say, was fascinating. It's just a great story, and it's a gripping tale of a unique personality. And so I got interested not just in Yogananda the teacher, but Yogananda the person, the human being. And so that led me to want to tell that tale in the full book.
You know, one of the great human pieces about him is you're recreating his childhood, kind of being spiritually advanced and yet still a kid. Talk a little more about that, how you put that together, where your information came from, and what you imagine Yogananda was like as a, let's say, partly enlightened child.
Well, there was actually a good deal written about it because his younger brother wrote a memoir about, you know, my life with my brother who became a world-famous guru. A couple of people in India wrote about it. But there was a lot unsaid. So I talked to people. I did whatever I could. In fact, there's far more new information about Yogananda in the parts of the book. Two-thirds of my book is about after he came to America. There's far more new stuff that was uncovered because I had access to things about his life in the West. But by going to India, by visiting the home that he lived in as a teenager, by speaking to a few survivor family members, well, they didn't know him personally, but like his, you know, two generations later who have, you know, absorbed all the family information, looking at the artifacts, things like that. You fill in details. And so I was able to fill in not only, you know, some details about his personal life and his family, but, you know, I was very interested in the environment, you know, what it was like in India in those days. What was Calcutta in particular like in those days? Because that's where he spent his teen years and his college years. And it turns out Calcutta was the sort of center of Indian cultural, spiritual, political reform.
Could you say it was on the Calcutting edge?
Oh, thank you. It was indeed on the Calcutting edge, and I will say it. And it has been compared. The Greenwich Village of those days has been compared to Calcutta in those days. You know, that sort of creative spirit and unique sort of individuals arising in the arts and in culture and new frameworks for spirituality and the very beginning of the Indian Indian political independence movement was really centered in Calcutta in those days. So I looked into what the environment was like geographically, physically, and culturally and all the rest to kind of speculate on the influences on Yogananda. At the same time, certain things could not be explained by the environment. They just were unique to his, you know, he was born a seeker. He was born somebody who knew he was destined to be a yogi and a spiritual leader and teacher. He was, you know, he was one of those people who as an adolescent was a ringleader. Only you and I grew up with ringleaders who were making mischief or, you know, organizing a party or a softball game. He was organizing satsang, spiritual gatherings. He opened a tiny little ashram when he was 15, you know, and he ran off. He left home and tried to escape to the Himalayas to, you know, be with the yogis several times, you know, beginning when he was 11. So, you know, there was a certain destiny to the whole thing and a mix of nature and nurture. But you also mentioned you mentioned in the context of your podcast, one of the things I want to emphasize is that he was a renunciate. He was a swami. He took vows, you know, when he finished high school to be a disciple of a guru and renounce worldly life and marriage and all that. And yet, the rest of his life, he was always very engaged. He worked very hard. He had a mission. And he was politically astute. That's one of the surprising things I found, how much he commented on from his platform as a increasingly famous spiritual teacher on what was going on at the time, the racism, the bigotry, the economic conditions that led to the Great Depression, and especially the Indian independence movement. It meant a lot to him. He knew Gandhi. He advocated for Gandhi in America. And I found that very inspiring because he became a sort of an example of how one can live a highly prioritized and deep spiritual life and not be detached from, you know, worldly affairs.
You know, one of the most interesting things about the book has to do with how he was initially received. Again, this is 25 or 30 years after Vivekananda came here,
right,
in the 1890s. And why don't you talk a little bit about why his guru sent him here, how that came about, and how he was received, and then finally how the backlash took place from the very same reactionary forces that are at work right now.
Well, fortunately, we can only summarize it so people will have to read the book.
That's all. Exactly. We want people to read the book. I was totally enthralled with this book, by the way. And not just because you're from Brooklyn, but I was.
I appreciate that, Steve. Yeah. His guru and his guru's guru, somehow they knew he was marked for the destiny of bringing the teachings of their lineage and the, you know, sort of wisdom of the Indian spiritual tradition, the wisdom of the sages, to the West. And he was kind of groomed for that job. And why? Who knows? You know, prophecy, insight, intuition, whatever cosmic attribution you want to make, but it came to pass. And so when he was 27, only a couple of years out of college, which his guru forced him to go to, you know, insisted that he get a college degree, he came to America. And, you know, the initial rationale for the trip was to speak at what we would think of as an interfaith conference in Boston. But that, you know, there was a larger purpose and a larger aim, and it turned out that, you know, he was able to stay. Now, there was always one of the things you discover when you do the kind of research I do, and it wouldn't surprise anybody who's paying attention to the current events, is that there were always two kinds of Americans, the ones who found a visiting teacher like Yogananda or Vivekananda or Maharishi or any of them to be worthy of listening to be curious about, to see if they have anything of use to say, to be fascinated by a person from another culture in another land, to treat them well, to treat them with dignity, and to treat them with respect. And then there's the other kind of chauvinist person, the closed-minded Americans who find the people like that threatening, who think of them as heathens, who think of them as, you know, somehow something to fear or to condemn. And so Yogananda faced both of that. He was welcomed with open arms by many people, especially curious seekers, spiritual seekers, treated well by many, many people, treated, you know, with reverence by some. And at the same time, he suffered a backlash. You know, you got to remember, this is 1920. And in the Ku Klux Klan was at its height. One of the things I discovered is in 1924, the Democratic National Convention in New York at Madison Square Garden, there were over 300 delegates who were known members of the Klan. And so it was a highly racist era. And, you know, if when he was traveling around the country by train or, you know, sometimes by car, you know, he had to deal with all that stuff, bigotry, fear that these, you know, yogis from India would hypnotize American women and have their way with them and, you know, all kinds of stuff. And threats on his life, and so he had to deal with it, as did gurus who preceded and followed him. But the more famous he became, of course, the more backlash there was, and the more reverence there was from the other side of the coin. And he dealt with all that stuff, and it was not easy. It was very difficult, and especially you know, when the Depression hit, he had to deal with. He had a growing organization. They owned property. He had to deal with, you know, great financial distress. And also, you know, at a time like that, more people are threatened by somebody who's an other and a foreigner mm-hmm. and all that. So that was, you know, the same mix of people who are making headlines today existed then, probably only more so.
You know, what was interesting is also that he changed his mission. He changed his mission from trying to speak to everybody to primarily focusing on building an organization and building a system for teaching and proliferating these ideas. So say a little more about that.
Well, that's you're right, and that's a pattern that I noticed that all the successful spiritual teachers had. At first, he was a one-man show, and he would go wherever he was invited to speak. He traveled incessantly for the first 10, 15 years of his time in America. Even when he established a property and a headquarters in Los Angeles, he was on the road most of the time. But as things developed, and his followers matured, and the people who were closest followers, the true disciples, were able to be trained to represent his teachings and become teachers in their own right. Then he could pull away from the incessant travel and having the spotlight on him as the sole teacher all the time to paying attention to the legacy, to the long term, to building, a functioning, highly functioning organization, making sure the finances were in place for the future. And that's especially true the last 10 or so years of his life, when he barely left Southern California, and he had centers in different places and people representing him who were doing the traveling, doing the teaching, doing the public face of things. And he focused on his written legacy, because he knew if he wrote the books he had in him, they would survive him, and establishing, you know, the people who would carry on after he was gone and all that. So that was the pattern. But I've also seen it in other gurus who came here.
Good. We're going to pick this up right after the break and talk about how all of this is relevant and pertinent right now. This is Steve Behrman on WikiPolitiki, and I'm talking with Philip Goldberg.
Free your mind with Om Times Radio, IOM FM.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
Hello, I'm Lisa Berry. Join me every Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time for Light on Living, a chance to see new, hear different, and feel more as I shine the spotlight on all the ways to lighten the load of life's challenges. Light on Living is your link to that new way you're looking for, that new understanding that will enhance your life, and that positive connection that will support your growth. So join me, and you'll gain insight and start to see things in a new way that motivates you.
The Shift Network, presenting transformative programs and events to help you awaken to your full potential so that together we can build the more beautiful world our hearts know is possible. Our classes support you in finding and cultivating your gifts and in bringing those gifts to the world to create tangible change and connect us as global citizens. Go to theshiftnetwork.com or follow the link on the Wiki Politiki sponsors page.
My name is Meera Batra, and this is How I Live United. Many families have come to America for a better life. I advocate for these families with United Way. United Way empowers them to see opportunities available. We help them get involved with their kids, schools, and network within the community. My name is Meera Batra. I help families see opportunity and succeed. I don't just wear the shirt. I live it.
Give, advocate, volunteer, live united. Go to liveunited.org. Brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
Hello again. This is Steve Behrman. I'm back on the last segment, Wiki Politiki discussion with Philip Goldberg. He's the author of American Veda and a new biography of Yogananda. Before we talk about the political implications of where we are now, one more thing about Yogananda. Obviously, in the last years of his life, he probably recognized that he had more limited time on the planet. He worked to complete his writings, his legacy. Talk a little bit about his samadhi, his final samadhi, how he died. And then one more thing. One of the things that intrigued me when I read Autobiography of Yogi is a little afterword in the back that said that he lied in state at Forest Lawn for a period of time, and his body emanated the scent of flowers. Now, when I watched the Awake movie, which was a really wonderful documentary that you appear in, there was nothing said about that. So I'm wondering, is that mythology? Is that something that people prefer not to talk about it because it's too woo-woo?
Well, Swami, it depends on who you talk to.
Doesn't everything.
Let's take it chronologically. He truly one of the most moving, if the most moving and satisfying segments of the book to work on was his last days. As you said, he knew, you know, as many people do, but especially, a highly conscious being like him, he had the sense that he would not live a long life. And so he was in a hurry to get a lot done to ensure his legacy would continue after his passing. And he worked really hard, probably, cutting even shorter his lifespan by, working too much. And the last days were fairly well chronicled by his close disciples, and I was able to supplement it by, in newspaper archives and things like that. And so I was able to write, and it was very moving to do that, to sort of imagine what it was like in 1952, in L.A., the circumstances of his final days and all that. And a lot of it was pretty uncanny. He used to say he loved India. He loved his homeland. But he only got to go there once for a full year, but just one visit in the 32 years after 1920. And always wanted to go back again and even book passage and never did. And his health started to fail toward the end. So he never went back, and he always said he'd die with India on his lips. And his last hours were spent at the Biltmore Hotel in Los Angeles, where there was a banquet for the Indian ambassador, the first Indian ambassador after India's independence, which meant a lot to him. And he was a keynote speaker, and he gave his talk, and he concluded his talk by reading some stanza from his poem about India, and died. And
heart attack. Simply died right on the spot.
On the spot at the podium, as soon as he concluded the reading from the poem, with India on his lips, as he predicted, which is pretty wild. And he passed, you know, he was 59. To skip to that famous passage, this is on the cover of most editions of Autobiography of a Yogi, or on the inside flap, rather. It talks about how he, you know, didn't decompose after a few weeks, and it's written by the coroner at Forest Lawn. However, it should be noted, and I noted in my book because I had to pay attention to this. To this day, it's a thing that people make a big deal of as indication of the purity of this great soul, that his body didn't decompose. But others have, you know, skeptics looked into it, and, you know, there's testimony from coroners and experts saying it's not that unusual, because he had been embalmed, and, you know, his body was encased in a glass thing after a few days, so people, you know, he lie in state, so to speak. And then he was interred. And so my personal feeling is, I don't know. I don't know whether it was just, you know, ordinary, you know, kind of thing that happens to a body, or it was something really unique and cosmic and special. But it doesn't matter. You know, people put a lot of emphasis on such things, and really, when it comes down to it, if you were to disinter Yogananda's body now and find a skeleton like any other skeleton, or he's immaculately preserved, it would not change anything about his teachings or his impact on the world. That's you know, he was a great teacher, he had a huge influence. And, you know, his legacy continues, and that's what's important.
Thank you for clearing that up. And, yes, of course, all of these myths hit. Maybe you and me, when it's our turn, there will be a smell of gefilte fish that emanates from there.
Yeah, right. Well,
something like that.
You that's just a, brought that's back a, old true. Memories of my grandmother's cooking, and we don't want to mess up the universe any more than it is.
Yeah, I think we'll stick with that. To wrap up this final segment, and boy, this went very quickly. You recently went to a conference on spirituality and politics, and I'm going to read a quote, which is their keynote quote, and then we're going to comment on that. Quote, "American democracy can flourish only when citizens are united at a deep level that transcends ideology, race, and class, to a shared spiritual and moral vision of what America could be." And you just came back from a conference where that was really the focus. So why don't you talk a little bit more about that and the relationship between the spirituality that you've been pursuing for the past half century and this dream that we have of a way of being, an apprehended sacred that transcends religion and non-religion.
Well, that's a big one, Steve. First, let me just say it was a conference co-sponsored by Spirituality and Practice Foundation, or spiritualityandpractice.com, and the Fetzer Institute. And if you go to spiritualityandpractice.com and look for their democracy project, you'll learn a lot about what they've been up to. You know, back in the 60s, to bring us full circle, you know, from the first part of the conversation, I was a political activist. I really wanted to change the world for the better, and I became very frustrated by the lack of progress and the craziness of, you know, the political movements I was exposed to. And then when I got into meditation and Eastern philosophy, I found a certain inner peace and a stability of mind that I didn't have before and didn't see in other people. And so I became a spiritual activist. And I thought, I was fond of saying, I'm changing the world one mantra at a time. And, you know, the notion came, you know, and it's a direct spiritual teaching from not just from India, but from all the mystical traditions, that the world has to change from the inside out. You change people. You change their consciousness. You change their ability to function harmoniously with each other and the world. You open their hearts. You open their minds. And then change will come from that, because it will, you know, flow as with the influence of individuals. I bought that and thought that's how the world would change, as a lot of others did in the 70s. You know, the Aquarian age is, you know, going to come from that. And over the years, especially the last few, I've realized, you know, it's not that simple. That's an important ingredient, an indispensable ingredient to, you know, to change the consciousness of humanity from the inside out. But that does not mean the social and political engagement is unnecessary. I was naive enough in the 70s to think that, but it's not. And we need, you know, spiritual people, people who are transforming themselves from the inside out and helping others to transform. We need them to take seriously their role as citizens as well as, you know, individuals. And I think that's a terribly important combination that Yogananda is actually a very good example of. And we all have our own ways of engaging in the larger community, whether it's a neighborhood or the city or the country or, you know, and at the very least, voting and encouraging others to vote. You know, there's a lot of parts of spirituality, especially mysticism and Eastern spirituality, that holds the world to be meaningless and illusory and, you know, polluted, so stay away. But there's another aspect of spirituality, of engagement, of engaged Buddhism, engaged Hinduism, engaged mysticism, where people are tending to their inner lives, but also taking seriously the outer world and the conditions that we all share. So I think what you're doing on your podcast is, you know, one of the voices for that kind of integration. And so I hope everybody's paying attention.
Well, you know, I think that this is really a fractal situation. It's happening. The same kinds of changes that are happening on the societal level are happening in the community level, the individual level, as, you know, in these times, we call it apocalypse, which really means the lifting of the veils. And, you know, just as the veils are being lifted on, you know, toxic perpetrations, in our lifetime, the veils have been lifted on ancient spiritual practices that are particularly pertinent and relevant for us now, that essentially give us a deeper cosmology and a deeper perspective on what it means to be human. And, you know, we are living in a time when, you know, current events, it's kind of like the joke, those who fail to learn the lessons of history condemn the rest of us to repeat it. You know, so we're at the point where we're at the effect of a lot of things, and yet there is a great awakening and uprising. Last couple of minutes, any final words for our listeners in regards to your work and what you would like to see, how you would like to see people take on this challenge that we just talked about?
Well, you articulated it very well, and I couldn't agree more. And these teachings that came from the East that I chronicled in these my last two books, they're not just a new perspective. They are, as you suggested, practices that are transformative. You know, this whole phenomenon of people turning within and engaging their deepest nature and bringing it out into the world, you know, this was not easy to do before the teachings of the East came here with all the spiritual methodologies like meditation and yoga. So I would encourage people to, you know, do that. Engage those practices, transform yourself, and be better citizens. As far as my work is concerned, I would just refer people to my website, philipgoldberg.com, which is the sort of the home of, you know, any information about me and my books and my public appearances and all that. And Spirit Matters, which is an excellent podcast.
I've been on there.
150. You have been on there. I was about to plug that. You are one of the 150 or so luminaries whom we have interviewed on that podcast, and I invite people to
find it. We're coming to the end of our show. This is Steve Behrman. I've been talking to Philip Goldberg. He's the author of The Life of Yogananda, the story of the yogi who became the first modern guru. Steve Behrman, Wiki Politiki. We'll catch you next week.